From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the GOP is reeling after last night's presidential debate.
If this is a true implosion, how far down the ballot does it travel?
Author Amy Heimerl on moving from Brooklyn to settle in an unloved old house in Detroit.
Everything had been scrapped. There wasn't a radiator. There wasn't a stick of pipe in there. There was no wiring left. We had to do everything. It's take it down to the walls and basically rebuild a house in a 100-year-old structure.
Taking aim at food waste in America.
It's coming right out of our refrigerators and either going into the trash and thence into the landfill or down our drain.
And that Michigan pounding of Rutgers.
How about putting the backups in the second half? Rutgers is that bad.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The aftermath of last night's Clinton-Trump debate has left the Republican Party in an all-out crisis mode. An NBC Wall Street Journal poll shows that following release of the tape of Donald Trump on the Access Hollywood bus, Hillary Clinton's lead over Donald Trump is now in double digits. And today, House Speaker Paul Ryan held a conference call with House Republicans saying he cannot and will not defend Trump and that House Republicans can do what's best for them in the remaining weeks of the election. But he will not take back his endorsement of Trump. What does this all mean for Republicans on the down ballot in Michigan? Here with us, Michigan Radio Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. And Rick, it seems the only Michigan elected GOP official to rescind his endorsement of Donald Trump is Lieutenant Governor Kelly.
Right. Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly said that instead he's going to write in the vice presidential candidate, Indiana Governor Mike Pence. But that will be a wasted vote that won't be counted. Basically, it'll be a symbolic measure because in Michigan, you have to file an affidavit that you're a candidate if you want to run as a write-in. But yeah, so far, it's a lot of people condemning the words, but very few people going to that final bridge of saying, like, nope, I can't support him, can't vote for him. And now it's just a question of what's next in terms of this damage control operation.
Yeah, and I've got to wonder. So you've got, for example, you've got Lieutenant Governor Kelly taking back his endorsement. You have Attorney General Schuette, Michigan GOP Chairman Ron Romney McDaniel condemning bus tape, but keeping their endorsements. What do you think the political consequences are of both positions?
Well, I think that if you look at Ronna Romney McDaniel's statement, that she made a point. The kicker to her statement was Donald Trump does not speak for all Republicans. And so when they're assessing, what they're going to do, that either they've got to decide that their prospects improve with a strong showing at the top of the ballot that just carries everyone else along, or at least doesn't hurt them, or that they've got to separate themselves and hope that voters will make the distinction between the Republican candidate for president and the Republican candidates for Congress, for state house of representatives, for those education boards. And right now there's a real fear, not that Trump will alienate moderate Republican voters, but that those moderate and who will come out and vote for Hillary Clinton, they're afraid that those voters will just throw up their hands and stay home on Election Day and not be there for all of those down ballot races.
Now, so the calculus, it must have changed for Michigan election races since that Access Hollywood tape exploded last Friday. Are we seeing once secure Republican seats in possible danger now?
That's the question, which is just how far, if this is a true implosion, how far down the ballot does it travel? How much does it reflect on other Republican candidates, especially the ones who said basically that at some level they still find Donald Trump, as offensive as he might be, to be tolerable as a possible next president of the United States?
Rick, how are Michigan Democrats making the most of the Access Hollywood busgate tape?
A lot of them are saying, you know what, we're just going to hang back and let the Republican Party destroy itself. But today, the Michigan Democratic Party did start sending out audio tapes that they've gone and gotten recordings of different Republican lawmakers and candidates endorsing Donald Trump. And they are now trying to make those statements as widely known and as widely circulated as possible so that they can win seats in the battleground areas like Oakland County.
Michigan Radio Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. As always, Rick, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Cindy.
And we reached out to Michigan GOP Chairman Ronna Romney McDaniel, as well as Lieutenant Governor Kelly, requesting an interview. Neither responded to our request. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it's time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubank. And we have to start with the Lions snapping that three-game losing streak as they squeaked past Philadelphia 24-23, but they sure didn't make it easy on anyone, did they?
They did not, and of course, Darius Slay, hats off, forces a fumble, gets an interception in about a minute and a half there, something like that. Lions fans, enjoy it while you can. It's a big win. I don't know how many more the Lions have this year.
Let's head over to college results because, my goodness, Michigan Rutgers 78-0. You know, and it's interesting. You got to think. 20 years ago, Loy Carr criticized teams for that very thing, and here was his quote. It's embarrassing, and it makes me mad that any coach thinks he has to do that to another team. New era?
No, because Harbaugh put in the backups in the second half. I mean, the starters left the first half, and they passed the ball three times in the entire second half. Any high school team will pass more than that, even in that situation. They took the foot off the gas. Rutgers is that bad.
Now, it seems probably the only ones in Ann Arbor not thrilled with Michigan's win might be the Ruth's Chris Steakhouse that seemed to have come up with a pretty cool promotion.
Pretty cool idea. The idea is if they win big, they will pay you that percentage off your bill. They did not anticipate 78-0. As the 78% off your bill, they found the fine print in the offer. They scaled it back to 50%, and now they're getting crap for that on ESPN. Marketing 101, don't turn a positive marketing thing into a negative where you just got how many millions of dollars of negative publicity from ESPN. Pay out the 78%. If you're going to eat the horse, eat the tail, be a hero. Change the plan for next week.
There you go. I think they're booked up for 5 days, so I don't think the chance of going to get 50% lobster or steak is available to
anyone
else.
It has worked out very well. Don't forget, also, alcohol is not on the list.
There you go.
So they'll make their money.
Now let's go over to Michigan State, where fans had exactly zero reasons to cheer on Saturday in that loss to Brigham Young, third straight. What's going on with the Spartans?
Look, we knew going into the season they had lost a lot of guys from last year's team to the NFL, to graduation, etc. New guys at a lot of key positions. I did not think it was going to be 2-3 bad, but I did think it was going to be obviously a restructuring, and that's what's happening right now. Don't count them out yet. It's going to be a so-so year. They're going to be a much better next year, and when they play Michigan at East Lansing, trust me when I tell you, circle that game.
Okay.
For all the cliches about throw the records out, Michigan State, for years when they were the underdogs, not the last 8 years, they beat Michigan 1 out of 3 games, always, always, always as the underdog. Usually Michigan's ranked. Usually Michigan State was not ranked, and it didn't matter. They have ruined countless Michigan seasons.
I heard BYU saying after there wasn't a single Spartan play they didn't know that they didn't see coming. What does that tell you about the Spartan play calling?
It tells you that Dave Warner, the offensive coordinator in his fourth year, who's not known to be that innovative to begin with, better go back to the drawing board, because when the college kids are seeing all the plays coming beforehand, that's not Tyler's fault. Tyler Connor, the quarterback.
Who got pulled
for Damian Terry, mm-hmm. who didn't do much better, frankly.
Got picked off right away.
Got picked off, yeah. Interception. You're putting the guy in a robbing position, and your O-line's not that good to begin with. That is a coaching issue.
We do have to give some love to Western Michigan, to Wayne State, to Central Michigan. All those fans have plenty to smile about.
Among those three teams, you've got, 15-3. Hats off to all three of those teams, of course. They're all headed for great seasons. Perhaps the most fun, I always enjoy talking about Cooper Rush.
Love that name.
Of Central Michigan, the quarterback. That's a marketing ploy right there. Another great game out of him, of course. But Western Michigan's Corey Davis, his one-handed catch in the end zone, is right now the top play on ESPN. Western Michigan's never had the top play, so hats off to them.
Finally, Brad Ausmus lives to fight another day for the Tigers.
I don't get it.
You've not been a fan. I know that.
I mean, likable guy, smart
guy.
Ivy League grad, all this good stuff. But they were the third highest payroll in major leagues. They were grossly underperforming this year. In the season, as well as in games. So many leads they had, they blew. Now, how much of that can you put on the manager when the pitchers pitch and the hitters hit or don't hit, etc.? So, if you like what you got this year, you got more coming.
Michigan Radio sports commentator, John Eubank. As always, thanks, John.
Thank you, Cindy.
America is changing, just in case you haven't noticed. Non-whites now make up a majority of kindergartners. By the next presidential election, the Census Bureau predicts they'll be a majority of all children. And by 2044, no one racial group will be a majority in this country. This cross-current of demographic and cultural change is upending traditional voting patterns and straining the fabric of just what it means to be American. Throughout this election season, NPR and its member stations have been having a national conversation called A Nation Engaged. The project has looked at central themes in this year's election, including this week's question, what does it actually mean to be American? For our contribution to the project, we put this question to some promising young spoken word artists, and we'll be sharing some of their poems with you all week. The first excerpt is from a poem entitled Apology to My Father by Shakila Islam, who's a sophomore at the University of Michigan.
It's been 2 decades since my father came here, and he's begun swallowing his pride like diabetes pills. Doctor's orders, be unseen, unheard. Unless you were born in this country, you'll always have second priority while sitting in the waiting room. But my father's sight has gone bad from turning a blind eye to the people who mock him so many times that he can't even read the fine print on his prescription. Maybe that's why he takes a little too much, overdosing on becoming a pushover in a society that has no problems pushing him over the edge. Father, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I'm writing a poem to you in a language you'll never fully understand. I'm sorry I don't even have the ability to properly tell you how much I love you because they didn't teach me your mother tongue in the school I was adopted into. I'm sorry this country is such a cruel lover to you, binding you to it with blackmail. I know you're only in this destructive relationship for the sake of your children and your children. With one foot in America and the other in Bangladesh, no, you can't fight a war when you're standing at the border. So when people fire insults, they follow in your footsteps, overdosing on silence, swallowing the pride of 1,000 sons and becoming shadows that can only carry apologies.
That was an excerpt from Apology to My Father, written and performed by Shakila Islam. She's a Bangladeshi immigrant and a graduate of Detroit Public Schools. You can read and listen to her poem in its entirety on our stateside page at michiganradio.org. Still to come, a long-forgotten medical musical with lessons worth remembering, and then in 10 minutes, how to prevent food waste in our homes. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Broadway musicals have covered a dizzying array of subjects. It may be hard to believe, but that list also includes the life and trials of a young physician. On this evening, 69 years ago, the medical musical Allegro opened on Broadway. Although it's long forgotten, U of M medical historian Dr. Howard Markell believes the lessons taught by Allegro are worth remembering today. And Howard, we should put it out right now. You, like I, you're a huge fan of Broadway musicals.
I am. My daughters tease me about it incessantly, but if it's been on the boards, I've seen it or I've heard it, I love it. Yeah.
Now, this one is incredibly obscure despite its impeccable pedigree. I mean, my goodness, Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Yeah. I mean, this was, in 1947, the hottest ticket in town this evening, 69 years ago. And Rodgers and Hammerstein were just coming off their mega hits, Oklahoma in 1943, Carousel, which is probably the best musical ever, in 1945. They also had that film State Fair that year. So they were hot. They were bigger than Hamilton. They were huge.
Spoiler alert, this was not a hit.
This was not a hit. It was a mega flop, particularly when compared to their previous two shows. Yeah.
Well, all right, so it's a flop, but you think this message is valid even today. So let's start with, what's the storyline? What's this musical about?
Well, it covers the life of a young man named Joseph Taylor Jr. It starts with his birth.
His hair is fuzzy, his eyes are blue, his eyes may change, they often do. He weighs 8 pounds and an ounce or two, Joseph Taylor Jr.
And we meet his mother, his grandmother, his father. And his father is a doctor in a small Midwestern town. Could be Ann Arbor, could be anywhere. And he is working against all odds to provide modern medical care, good medical care, for his poor patients living there. And Joe Jr. is tapped to become the successor and join that practice from the day he is born.
However, the childhood sweetheart is the spoiler, isn't she?
Yeah, there's a childhood sweetheart, Jenny Baker, who really fascinates and attracts young Joe. And she is not that excited about a life in a small town. In fact, she encourages Joe Jr. to take an internship in a big city hospital to lead to a better life and a better living, which means they'll make a lot more money.
So he gets married and he does that. But he goes to the big city and what, it doesn't work out as he thought?
It doesn't work out. I mean, Joe Jr. probably should have taken as a hint in the end of Act One when his deeply disappointed mother dies of a heart attack because she thinks he has chosen the wrong mate.
Well, ultimately then, how do things end?
Well, he goes to the big city hospital and he rises and he's, you know, in a whirl of parties and he's raising money and he's treating the worried well, the wealthy well, with vitamin shots. And of course, he's so busy that Jenny becomes bored and has an affair with the head of the board of trustees of the hospital he works at. So this disappoints Joe Jr. quite a bit, as you can imagine. He also has a few misdiagnoses that his nurse helps him with to correct. And he decides, you know, I treated this young man with TB back in my old hometown, and I think I gave him more. I did more for him than I did in the last 5 years. And so he decides to go back to the town where he grew up and become a real doctor as opposed to a show doctor at the big city hospital.
And I love the way you write in your piece about Allegro that this is really something that you would like to prescribe to your medical students, to your colleagues, despite, as you say, the clunky yet profound Allegro.
Yeah, the score is not Richard Rodgers' best. He was a brilliant composer, but I think he phoned this one in. And really tells you to follow your dreams and to follow the things that you know are right. As opposed to being persuaded by money and really infatuated with material success. And you really ought to follow your heart and do what you first set out to do in terms of your goals.
Now, did anyone ever try to revive it? I mean, even knowing it folded pretty quickly back in the 40s, was there ever an attempt to revive it?
Well, it's largely relegated to that heap of flops that no one reads or sees. But it has had – it's popped up its head every now and then. A few years ago, it had an off-Broadway run. And this past summer, it had a very successful run in London. But it's not performed by high schools or things like that, but it is an interesting piece nevertheless. And it was recently in 2009, the Rodgers and Hammerstein Organization, which is the keeper of the flame, did a complete recording because originally in 47 they just did 10 songs. And there's also a Greek chorus in this musical following Joe and singing to him or about him as he proceeds in his life. So we now have the complete score, and it's well worth listening.
Now, I got to wonder, want to place any odds on someone else maybe trying a medical musical? I mean, medical TV shows are still a thing, and if someone could make a smash musical about Alexander Hamilton, why not?
I'd be in the first row applauding if they did. I think it's ripe. And, you know, it's not just about a doctor who decides to go for the money instead of becoming a caring physician. Oscar Hammerstein wrote it largely about himself. And he was this great librettist and lyric writer and poet. And, you know, by the way, before he met Richard Rodgers, he had a string of flops. Showboat was his first big hit. And then he had flop after flop after flop. But once Oklahoma came about and then Carousel, he was inundated with requests. Will you be the president of this organization? Will you speak for that organization? And he wasn't doing what he truly loved, which was creating art. And so he was thinking about himself when he wrote about Joe Jr.'s infatuation, his seduction with the wrong path.
It's a good lesson whether you have MD after your name or not.
I think it is.
You have been medical historian and PBS commentator, Dr. Howard Markel. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Collaborative
experimentation.
The next idea.
We need a participation revolution, and we need it fast.
The amount of food that we waste in this country is staggering, and half of it happens right out of our own homes, food we throw out. A project called ReFed, Rethink Food Waste Through Economics and Data, recently released what it calls a roadmap to reduce U.S. food waste. One of the leading participants in this national effort is an Ann Arbor sustainability and recycling consulting firm called Resource Recycling Systems, or RRS. With us now for the next idea, RRS President J.D. Lindeberg. Welcome, J.D.
Well, thank you very much.
And we welcome Hunt Briggs. Hunt is a consultant for RRS and the project manager for this major food waste report. Hunt, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
This report, Roadmap to Reduce U.S. Food Waste, states really a stunning fact, and I'm going to read it from the report. The United States spends $218 billion a year growing, processing, transporting, and disposing of food that's never eaten. That's a lot of money and a lot of waste. Can you break it down for us? Where is all this waste coming from, J.D.?
A lot of it's coming right out of our refrigerators and either going into the trash and thence into the landfill or down our drains. And I think one of the tragedies there is that much of it is preventable. It hurts us in two ways. We spend too much money on it. And secondly, it ends up in a landfill where it becomes methane, and that's not good either.
What about outside of our homes, Hunt? Where else is this coming from?
What the ReFed report and roadmap sought to do was identify exactly that. You know, where is the waste originating? And we found that about half of the waste, just under half, about 43%, is coming out of homes. But the remaining 57%, about 25 million tons a year, is coming from businesses. Restaurants could be fast service restaurants. It could be sit-down restaurants. Small amount is going to waste from manufacturing sector. They produce a lot of waste but have pretty good supply chain already to recover a lot of that waste.
How about the farm level?
Farm level, we estimate that about 10 million tons is generated at the farm level.
When you think about this, we see nearly half of food waste happening in our homes. That's huge because it's something that we can do and to change. I think so many of us, I am certainly among them, guilty of tossing out leftovers that you put in the back of the fridge and then you forget about it, or you don't finish that gallon of milk by the sell-by date. Hunt, what are some of the things that we can do in our homes to decrease the food waste?
I think one of the things that jumped out at us in this study was the need for better date labeling. There's a huge potential for return on investment for standardizing date labels so that consumers understand when their food is expected to be past the consumption date. Right now, we have a lot of mixed signals reaching consumers. We have sell-by dates, we have best-by dates, we have expiration dates, and a lot of those are targeted to retailers and not actually consumers. We end up throwing away a lot of food that we think is bad, but actually isn't past the safe level of consumption.
I think you're absolutely right. Somebody will see a date and go, oh, get rid of it. You're right. We are very confused about those. The other thing I'm wondering is just about, if you have any thoughts, J.D. Lindeberg, about our buying habits. You go into, you know, the stores where you can go into those warehouse stores and get big cartons of all kinds of things, and you think, what a deal I'm getting, and you come home with a lot of things more than your family may need. Are we in that habit of overbuying?
certainly we have the bulk buying opportunities that have saved a lot of people a lot of money. But at the same time, if you buy twice too much and it has to then be thrown out, that's not helping you from a savings perspective at all. One of the other areas that we set targeted was a very significant effort to educate consumers. Make use of social media to do some large-scale consumer advocacy campaigns that raise awareness about food waste and give consumers an idea about how they can save money, reduce this wasted food. We can create a better set of date labeling, and we can get people thinking about how to make better use of the food in the home and perhaps in smaller portions as well. There's some good opportunity here for greater health. I mean, I think this is an issue that has health implications, it has money-saving implications, and it has really tremendously beneficial environmental implications.
I want to ask you, Hunt Briggs, what's the big picture for Michigan?
Organics is an immense fraction of the material that is going to landfill annually, and it also presents one of the biggest opportunities for Michigan to increase its recycling rate. When you look at the community level and you think about what can communities do that will have comprehensive and holistic impact on getting more materials diverted from landfill, you have to start with food waste. You have to think about how we can get food waste that's being generated at the consumer level in households, also at businesses at the commercial level, diverted from landfill. So we need to work on instituting diversion opportunities, pathways where those businesses and consumers can actually take their food and send it to either centralized composting or backyard composting or other solutions.
JT, what would get us in an even better position? I mean, if you were to call the governor right now and recommend some really big picture waste reduction methods to Michigan's food system, what would those look like?
There's no question that you see really good food waste recovery statistics in states that have very aggressive policy approach to handling it. There's two different ways to handle that. One is some states have chosen to simply ban food waste disposal in landfills. Another approach is to say, we have a waste stream, we expect 60, 65% recovery of that waste stream. And if you then include all of the recycling and recovery options, you really have to have a strong food waste recovery program. The final thing that's somewhat controversial, but this is an excellent circumstance where a carbon tax would work very well, because most of the food, when it goes to a landfill, becomes methane. And methane, because it's such a global climate change gas, 24 times carbon dioxide on equivalent carbon basis. If we were able to properly value carbon emissions in this country, you wouldn't see any food waste at all going into the landfills for two reasons. One is it would avoid all the methane emissions. And two, you would find much of it being composted. And as it's composted, it then gets used as a soil amendment where you get further carbon sequestration in the earth. There is sort of a circle of life for food waste, and that is that it starts out as food. We use it. If we don't use it, it then goes back to either a donation process or a reuse process or then finally a recycling process, and it gets turned into a soil product and gets put back in the soil to grow more plants. When you complete that circle, you have some tremendously beneficial things that happen.
And you factor in these prevention techniques that we were talking about, things that we could do to prevent this waste from happening from our own homes.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you this, nothing pays back as quickly as prevention, because the cost of growing food in this world for Americans in particular, with the meat that we eat, the cheese, the highly processed material, the lettuce that comes from California, carries with it a very significant carbon footprint. And when we waste it, we lose that whole cost structure that's behind it.
Hunt, what is at stake if we don't change our wasteful ways?
Hundreds of billions of dollars are at stake. These are billions of dollars that we're currently losing today. The baseline of what we are literally and figuratively throwing away is staggering. It's so staggering that it actually is measured as significant points against our total GDP. There's a huge opportunity that is lost if we don't actually take measures such as the ones laid out in the roadmap to recapture the value that we're wasting.
J.D. Lindeberg, what's at stake?
This is all about food for the future. We have a very quickly growing population in the world. And at the same time, that same world is stressed by what is very clearly a significant changes in our climate. We can argue about how those changes are being driven and what to do about them. But the fact of the matter is, in an environment where we have greater demand for food, less opportunity for production, wider range of very extreme weather events, we're going to have to focus very, very carefully on having enough food for our world's population to eat. We have to take advantage of all of the organic resources we have, and we simply can't afford to send those resources to the landfill. We need to make sure that they can, where appropriate, be donated, and we can end up with another billion meals available for simply donation programs. Those materials that can't be donated, they need to be reprocessed, turned into energy and soil products, and put back in the land so it can continue to grow the food for next generations.
J.D. Lindeberg is the president of the Ann Arbor-based Resource Recycling Systems, or RRS. Hunt Briggs is a consultant for RRS, and he was the project manager for this major food waste report titled Roadmap to Reduce U.S. Food Waste. You'll find that report on REFED's site. That's REFED, R-E-F-E-D, .com. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you for being with us on The Next Idea.
Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. It's our pleasure.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Up next, one couple's story of moving from Brooklyn to Detroit and turning a stripped-out, unloved house into a home. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For any first-time homebuyer, it is a great big step, a heavy lift. You're trying to figure out the finances. There's work to be done to make the place your own. And there's the process of getting used to your new place, wondering how long until the new sights, sounds, and feel of that house and new neighborhood stop feeling strange and novel and start feeling like home. Take all of that and turn it up to 11. And that's what buying their first home in Detroit was like for writer Amy Heimerl and her husband, Carl Kabnick. Amy takes us along their voyage of home ownership in Detroit's West Village in her memoir, Detroit Hustle, a memoir of love, life, and home. Pleasure to have you with us, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me, Cynthia.
I did love reading this book because you have the courage I would never have to take that plunge and have the vision to see in a wrecked hulk of a house what could be a home.
Well, I appreciate that you think that I had a vision or courage. It was really more just leap first, look later. I think that's been my entire life. If I knew what I was doing when I embarked on it, I would never do it. But, you know, I've had many great adventures, including this one, and it's a lot of look at, you know, leap and then look.
Well, you and Carl were living in Brooklyn. You had a good life there, it seems.
Absolutely. We loved our neighborhood of Red Hook, Brooklyn. It was wonderful, but prices were certainly rising like so many cities in this country. And we had just gotten married. I earned a fellowship at the University of Michigan, which brought us here from Brooklyn originally. And then we were really thinking about what do we want to do next? Do we want to go back to Brooklyn or try something else in our life? And we were drawn to Detroit.
Now, there are people that would think the be-all and the end-all is Ann Arbor, but that was not the fit, clearly, for you or Carl.
It was not. Ann Arbor was a great town for the 9 months we were here for the fellowship, loved University of Michigan, but it wasn't a great fit for us. And I think anywhere would have been a hard fit for us after coming out of Red Hook, which was this incredibly tight-knit neighborhood, very walkable, all the small business owners that we knew. Anywhere was just going to be a huge cultural shift from that. And so as we got here, we started exploring Detroit, and we just really clicked with the people of Detroit and this city that, you know, everywhere else people are saying, that's the murder capital of America. That's, you know, it's a hellhole. We can't, you know, who would go there? And for some reason, we fell in love with it, with the small beauty. It's a city that sort of unfolds itself to you slowly. But the people were warm and welcoming, and we just felt this pull that felt right. My husband loved it more than I did, to be honest.
It's clear from reading Detroit Hustle, Carl had his heart in this idea of we're going to find a house and we're building our life in Detroit a little more than you did.
Right. For me, I'd visited Detroit about a decade before that with my best friend just for vacation to see the DIA. And Detroit sort of became this idea, like if I ever needed a plan B, it was a plan B, but it was always more of an idea. And when I got to Detroit, I was like, oh, that idea and the reality, there's some distance between the two things. But my husband saw the power and the beauty of the city from the first moment and sort of helped me see that too. I loved the people from the first moment, but wasn't sure I was ready for, I think I say in the book that a place like Red Hook, which was equally disinvested, equally struggling, especially when, you know, we moved in there. It once had a pack of feral dogs roving the waterfront, no public transportation. You know, most of the citizens live in public housing. It's a very poor, forgotten about area. But that can look quaint in 1 square mile with cobblestone streets. It looks very different when you're looking at 139 square miles mm-hmm. and having to think about how do you come to a place, reinvest in it, help bring, you know, city services, be a part of that community that is struggling so hard. It's, you know, it's less sort of dreamy and picturesque and it's more real. But Carl and I realized that's what we wanted. We wanted to be a part of a place that was figuring out its future, not to, you know, as I say to everybody, not to save Detroit, but to be a part of the Detroit that exists and sort of pushing it along for everybody.
And we are going to talk about that a little later, that idea of what the role is of someone like you coming into Detroit. But first, the house. You discover the house in the West Village on Van Dyke Place. So it's the east side of Detroit. Named it Matilda. Why did you name it Matilda?
So my husband named it Matilda after the Tom Waits song Waltzing Matilda, because as he tells me in that song, there's sort of a grand old dame that's seen better days and is, you know, still really beautiful in her way. And he saw that in Matilda. I honestly don't necessarily get the connection, but my husband calls her Matilda, and so there we went, and she is now Matilda.
And you open the book by taking us on a walk through the house, just in a nutshell. I mean, there's fixer-uppers, and there's fixer-uppers.
This is definitely a fixer-upper.
In all caps.
All caps. This, we did not want a big renovation project. We thought we were going to buy something that was like, you know, a little cosmetic, fix the kitchen,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And then we bought a house that had no plumbing, no heating, no electrical, and I don't just mean like it was missing a boiler. Everything had been scrapped. There wasn't a radiator. There wasn't a stick of pipe in there. There was no wiring left. We had to do everything. It's take it down to the walls and basically rebuild a house in a 100-year-old structure.
And you are a finance writer. Wasn't everything in your brain going, what am I doing?
Yes. So as I tell everybody, the one thing about personal finance writers and editors is that we are not, you should never take our advice. We are here to write about the follies and foibles of that all of us do. And you should, I grew up very poor. So I've been through a lot, including knowing, like, I know what it takes to be at a pawn shop. I know what it means to have to do payday lending just to get by week to week. So I can understand that from other people's perspectives. But that also means maybe do as I say, not as I do.
Right. And when you think about also, here we are talking 2012, 2013, couldn't get a mortgage. Can't get a construction loan because?
Because houses just aren't worth anything in Detroit, especially at mm-hmm. that time. It's starting to change now, but banks yeah. don't want to lend on a house that's going to cost more to fix up than it will be worth when it's done.
I'd like if you would read us an excerpt from Detroit Hustle. And this is a point where you are trying to decide whether or not to take this plunge.
Absolutely. After all, we are talking about a pretty serious investment in a city we barely know, in a neighborhood we visited fewer than a half dozen times, and in a house that doesn't meet any of our initial criteria. It has no front porch. It's a full gut rehab. And although there are rumors of new restaurants and cafe openings, they are just that. Rumors. But we're not the first couple to stare down the barrel of this decision. This isn't Star Trek. We're not boldly going where no man has gone before. 700,000 people still live here, build their lives here, for better and for worse. We're simply moving to a city that's down on its luck. We're not joining the Peace Corps or embarking on a humanitarian mission. Plus, if we manage to stay married and not kill each other, we'll have a fabulous home for a fraction of what our friends in Brooklyn pay in rent for their apartments. But what if it all goes entirely wrong? I can't even fathom that. But neither do I want my fears, the sins of my past, to prevent my kind and loving husband from enjoying his dreams. I know how much this place means to Carl, and I love the way he believes that this giant mess of a house can one day be a home for us. He believes in me, he believes in our future, and I believe in him. Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose.
That is Amy Heimerl reading from her new book, Detroit Hustle, a memoir of love, life, and home. You took the plunge. You began construction in July 2013. So you bought the house for $35,000?
$35,000.
And you spent over $400,000 in a year and a half. I got anxious for you reading the whole story.
It was very anxious at the time, not knowing where yeah. the next pot of cash is going to come because there weren't mortgages. And so that is the struggle of the Detroit real estate market, is if it's a struggle for, quite honestly, a middle-class couple coming with some access to resources for the first time in my life. But having that, what does it mean for the people who live in Detroit just to be able to maintain their homes and properties?
And you made it happen.
We did make it happen.
You should do a shout out to your wonderful contractor, Cal.
Oh, we are so blessed. Cal and Christian Garfield, father and son team based in Detroit. Most people don't have a great relationship with their contractors. We are like family now after this. We lived in the house during construction and we still love them. They are the guys that made this possible.
On a scale of 1 to 10, Amy, 1 being the total wreck you found Matilda the first day and 10 being that everything done exactly as you want, where would you put Matilda on that scale today?
I would say we're at about a 7.5. Most of the house is done. We still need to paint. I'm a little intimidated by painting a 3,000-square-foot house, so it's going slowly. We need gutters. We need some closet doors. Most of the work is actually still in rebuilding the garage. It's a falling down wreck of a place. We need to deal with that. That's the big project.
Your journey with Matilda corresponded in the very same time when Detroit was journeying through the biggest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. And you really do an elegant job of kind of talking about that, because as you talk about Detroit and recovery, you can't have that discussion without talking about the neighborhoods.
Absolutely. So we bought the house, and 6 weeks later, Detroit entered bankruptcy. You know, and a lot of friends and family were saying, oh my gosh, are you sure you don't want to rethink this? But we bought not ever thinking Detroit, making any bets on Detroit either way. So for us, you know, it looked like an opportunity for Detroit to clean up its balance sheet, but also to really think about how do we reinvest in the neighborhoods? How do we address an issue where we have 40% poverty and so many people can't afford to pay their water bills? So the book really does bookend about that. We finally get the appraisal on our house and ability to get some financing about 2 years later, right as Detroit is also coming out of its bankruptcy. So the book really does be able to look at our house is a microcosm of the bigger macro issues that Detroit's facing through its bankruptcy.
You do write, Amy, very, very eloquently about this wrestling, and it is quite a struggle you describe. The questions of whether you're really, truly contributing to Detroit, what it means to be a Detroiter, that conflict you feel about being in there as a newcomer, and gentrification. Why did it feel to you, and here were your words, as if the mere hint of success makes you irredeemable in the eyes of Detroit?
I think it's something I'm wrestling with, period, coming from my background. I said I grew up in a trailer in rural Colorado. So it's the American dream, right? So my parents wanted better for me. I'm the first and only person in my family to go to college. So I did that. I did the work, and now I'm here as sort of a successful member of the middle class. But when we look at Detroit and it's so poor and so poverty stricken that it can, you know, if you don't know that background about me and you've seen so many New York Times articles or other media write about Detroit and it's just telling the story of new white, you know, people coming to Detroit and starting their businesses or artists thinking of it as a blank slate or an opportunity to save the city, it would be really hard to see me as anything but that and not know my background. So I come from a place, very small town, where you have to earn your way in, where people don't necessarily trust. It's a very sort of village mentality. And if you come from someplace like New York or San Francisco that's more transient, people moving in and out, you're used to that. If you're a place like Detroit or smaller towns, you're used to more of a village where people are really committed and you know families and histories generations back, and Detroit is sort of that way. So me struggling with who am I? What are the assumptions people make about me? How do I present myself? How do I show that I want to come and just be a part of this city?
You know, that word gentrification, what does it mean to you?
I mean, so I think that what it means more technically is a looking at a place where people are being displaced for those with higher levels of education or income. I think Detroit, that's actually not what we're seeing yet, except for in tiny pockets, but what we see is a cultural gentrification. And that is more about as people come in and expect a city to contour to them as opposed to coming in and expecting yourself to contour to the city. And I think I learned that very much in Colorado, where my family is being technically gentrified out. They don't want my dad's, muddy boots and rumbling trucks anymore as they build million-dollar condos, downtown where I'm from. They don't want to see that work. So I'm very sensitive to that idea of how do we make sure that everybody is welcome, and that when you come to a new place, when you're making yourself, known, that you can't just expect it to be where you came from, but cheaper. You have to go to it because you love it, because you want to be there. If you're just moving somewhere because it's cheaper, and then you try to force it into, something else, that's always going to cause conflict. And so I'm, because I've lived through that my entire life in some way, I'm sensitive to it in Detroit. And it's, you know, on steroids there, the conversation, because you add race and class.
Mm-hmm. Because, yes, when you're questioning, as you kind of write through these questions in your book, it seems you're questioning whether you have a rightful place at the table in Detroit. And I think, but you took a home that was the neighborhood. I saw your neighbors very delighted. Oh, my goodness. Someone's going to love this house. You poured attention and money and love into the neighborhood, into the house. So is that unease based on your skin color?
I don't think that it's unease based on my skin color. I think it's fundamentally because we've had nothing but sort of people welcome us for the most part and really be just generous to us. And our neighbors are thrilled that we've taken this house that sat empty for almost a decade and was something they had to maintain and was an eyesore and a problem for them. They're thrilled. And we've helped bring up property values around us just because we took a house, we were able to get a mortgage on it later, finally, you know, create a higher level of property value. That's great for everybody around us because suddenly people who've been underwater on their on their homes, who've been there for decades, suddenly have value, mm-hmm. which means they could suddenly sell. Which is great for them because what if you need to put a kid through college? Or what if you have mom or dad who needs to go into assisted living? Suddenly, this is how Americans get pots of cash. They sell their homes that they've invested in for most of their lives. Finally, our neighbors have that ability. But suddenly, that also means those houses are now priced at $200,000, which mm-hmm. people think is too expensive for Detroit. And so are you gentrifying mm-hmm. because you took a historic – you were part of making a historic district – and those homes that are in them actually be valued at a more reasonable amount. Like homes in a historic district can't go for $35,000 in a functioning city that's actually going to have enough money for city services to address lights and trash pickup. And fundamentally, having enough money in a pot to be able to help people pay their water bills. Like how does the city that built the middle class sort of reabsorb a middle class or rebuild a middle class, which is what I think Detroit needs to focus on, is not just rebuilding by importing people like my husband mm-hmm. and I, but also figuring out what we do to create jobs for those who are already there. One of those ways is actually being able to hire contractors and hire suppliers like Carl and I did and making sure that they have jobs and we value that. People often, I have found when they talk about this house and what we've spent, they're appalled because we didn't just go cheap, that you could always just do it cheap. And you can, but I grew up in a construction household. I grew up being taught by my father that you do it right the first time and you allow a man to feed his family and you pay a working wage, that, you know, just because you have a dream, some other contractor is not obligated to give it to you at dirt cheap just because you have the money to spend. So it was very important to me that Carl and I hire local. Cal and Christian Garfield, you know, for 2 years, they had a job because of us, and now they have many other jobs. But if we don't value that and we aren't willing to invest and see that as economic development and buying all of our materials from local vendors, that is how we sort of help rebuild the middle class, by valuing those jobs.
The question you posed toward the end of your book, and I'm wondering if you've got an answer worked out in your mind since you wrote the book, will we learn to coexist together, the new and the old?
I think that the answer is, even just since I wrote the book, I don't know that I would frame it as new and old. That I've come even to a deeper thinking that there is one Detroit, and if we think about it as new and old, we automatically separate ourselves. But if there is a place for everybody at this table, but I think there's a lot of respect and showing respect when you come. And that's not something a lot of people are used to when they move into a new city. They're used to just being able to come and and live their lives. And yeah. Detroit's a more complicated experience than that, not just because of the background and the racial history and the class mm-hmm. history, but just because of the media history and how the media has reflected Detroit to Detroiters. So I feel like Detroiters are myself included now, are automatically a little skeptical of newcomers or how media is presenting it, because you look at it and you go, how should people who've stayed here their lives, who didn't leave when they could have, how are they supposed to feel? You know, a very significant African-American middle class, when all they see reflected back in national media is people look like my husband and I. That's creating the challenge. I think as a writer, I have an obligation to be looking at some of that.
wonderful, wonderful book, Detroit Hustle, a memoir of love, life, and home. Amy Heimerl, congratulations. I loved reading your book. You made me cry at parts. You wrote about your dad's business when it collapsed, and it brought me to tears, and I thought about that story being echoed across the country and what you're doing as well. It was a great read.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. It was great to be here.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. The show's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.